Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and the health status of our food, water, air, earth. We talk about the health of our communities, the health of our society, the ecological balance and stability of planet Earth. And each week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different scientists, doctors, educators, thought leaders, advocates, activists, filmmakers, journalists, and all of the people who cover different aspects of our interconnected world and the way it impacts our own well-being. This week on the show, I have two doctors returning to speak to us about a topic very dear to this audience, which is environmental health and the impacts between what is going on in terms of toxins and toxicants in our environment and how that impacts us, as well as, you know, some thoughts about what we can do to address it, both in a personal health sense and in a larger sense, because since we began covering these topics, you know, Connect the Dots has been on the air, is now going into its eighth year. The need to really understand how societal choices are impacting us personally and our personal health has never been greater, as we see reading the news every day. So let me introduce our two guests, and I'm so honored to have them both with us. Dr. Joseph Pizzorno is the author of The Toxin Solution, and he has appeared on the program before. He is a co-founder of Bastyr University and a teacher of several generations of naturopathic physicians and a pioneer in both that medicine, that modality, as well as in the practice of it and the education about it. He is also deeply involved with the whole founding of functional medicine, which is really kind of the center pin in healthcare nowadays because it really bridges the scientific and evidence-based orientation, so highly valued in conventional medicine, while really drilling in much deeper and more accurately and successfully into what helps specific systems of the body function and what really harms that. Also with us today is another returning guest. He's Walter Crinian, who's been a pioneer of environmental health and treating it and trained many, many different practitioners in how to do that. He was on here several years back for his first group, which is still a classic, Clean, Green, and Lean. And the two doctors have actually co-authored a book on environmental medicine, which will be coming out later this year. Dr. Crinian is the founder of the Naturopathic Association of Environmental Medicine, a specialty board for those in the field that sets standards of care and provides board certification to doctors in these arenas. So, as you can tell from these two exceptional guests, we're going to be talking today about the effect of chemicals, toxins, and other things in our environment. I don't usually like to call them environmental because they're in the environment. They didn't necessarily come from the environment. Very often they're man-made or extracted and then, you know, kind of unleashed upon us, you know, in our outer world. So, you know, we can't blame the earth and the natural world for, you know, industrial toxins and other things. So we're going to be talking today about the current status of public health and how it's really impacted by the presence of these various industrial ingredients, where they come from, and what we can do about them. So welcome, Drs. Pizzorno and Crinian, to Connect the Dots. Are we doing in making sure that the various toxic chemicals, from pesticides to industrial releases like mercury, you know, or heavy metals in fracking, or, you know, fracking chemicals, how good a job are we, or, you know, to the ingredients in cosmetic products or consumer items or even furniture, how good a job are we doing at assuring that the chemicals that are used are, you know, safe for use and safe for public exposure?
Is this a trick question?
Right. Because well, you know, I weigh in on that a lot, but you're doctors, you know, so I'd like to hear it from your perspective, you know, what you see and what your perception of that is.
Well, the answer is that there is no oversight on that, really. There just isn't. You know, industry comes up with a chemical that works good for something, and they start using it, like bisphenol A, for example. And then it's found to have tremendous adverse health effects. Now, in the case of bisphenol A, it was known to be estrogenic, you know, decades earlier. And now they're simply replacing it with other bisphenols, the phthalates that the plasticizers that were used to make plastic components a little bit more flexible, and they don't bind to the plastic well, so they release into the home air, and are found in literally everybody, multiple phthalates found in everybody in North America. And now they're replaced with other compounds that are now being found in everybody, these non-phthalate plasticizers, which we have yet to know what the adverse health effect is, because there has been no study on these things before they're put in. So there is no, literally no oversight, Allison, on any of this. It's buyer beware. Or liver beware.
Because that's where the body has to deal with them. You know, okay, so basically what you're saying is it's buyer beware. It's up to us. And, you know, how do you know and how have you tracked what the actual negative health impacts or bodily effects of these different chemicals are? Because clearly science, we may not have any protection, but we do have some scientific smoking guns and data and understanding, as well as clinical observation and treatment, which is, you know, what both of you teach and do. How do we know what the actual health impacts are through these various means? Like, what are the means through which you can track that, and, you know, and what do they what do those avenues reveal in terms of the impact on our health?
I can answer that. There's a couple of ways of going about this. One is to look at, for example, what happens in animals when they're exposed to high levels of these toxins, or even modest levels of toxins over long periods of time. That can give us good information. But unfortunately, we're way past the stage where we need to look at animal research to determine how these things are damaging our health. So a project I worked on, and which led to the publisher being interested in funding you and I writing that book, is I started looking at a very simple question, and that is, if you look at people in the top level of exposure to particular toxin, and to compare the disease load to people at the lowest level of exposure to the toxin, is there a difference in their disease load? And unfortunately, the answer is very, very clearly yes, uncontroversially. And when we start looking at, for example, people who have the highest levels of organochlorine pesticides in the blood, and then compare to people's lowest levels, look at things like diabetes, and they have like 8 to 20 times as much diabetes. We start looking at, ADHD in children, and children with highest levels of organophosphate pesticides have way more ADHD. You can just look at disease after disease that becomes prevalent in our society, and you find that the people with the highest levels of toxins have the most levels of those diseases. So that leads to the third thing, where we say, okay, well, if indeed there's a high correlation between high levels of the body in the body of these toxins and these diseases, is there a mechanism? And it turns out we now know the mechanisms. So, for example, with many of these chemical toxins that are caused to increase diabetes, they have two mechanisms of action. One is they bind to the insulin receptor sites in the cells, so cells can't respond to insulin anymore, which means that our poor pancreas has to overproduce insulin in order to get sugar to the cells. We do that long enough, and the pancreas burns out because there's been just so much excess demand of the organ that was not designed for. And then you look at the pancreas itself, and it turns out that the higher the person's arsenic levels, the less effective their pancreas is at producing insulin. And you might say, well, arsenic, you know, who gets arsenic toxicity? Well, there was a great study that Walter found looking at 20,000 people in Italy where they followed them for 20 years, then looked at the levels of arsenic. There was one province in Italy where they had a wide range of arsenic exposure depending upon their water supply. And what they found was that people with high levels of arsenic had way more disease, not just diabetes, but cancer and brain disease and things of this nature. And they determined the threshold from an arsenic piece being a person's body before you start seeing this increase in disease. And we look at that threshold and then look at the numbers of levels of arsenic in people in the United States. And 1/4 of people in the United States have arsenic levels that are known to increase the risk of disease. So it's just not only do we see the correlations, but we see the mechanisms, and we are seeing huge incidence of disease in our society.
That's really an important point. I mean, you know, what happens is we get these sort of, you know, universal or these U.S. Health outcome statistics. You know, these are the rates of diseases. But, you know, and then people are like, oh, my God, how do we treat them? And then, you know, well, we'll surgically remove this and we'll surgically remove that. You know, or unfortunately, this isn't working anymore, that isn't working, or now you have this disease, you need a medication to treat this disease. And what you're both saying is that these diseases didn't just, you know, spring up out of nowhere. They actually have a cause. And instead of getting ahead of the curve, to say, what are the causes and can't we address this at the causal level before the problem happens by, you know, reducing exposure and use to all of these chemicals, you know, and thereby prevent disease. You know, the conventional medical system talks about disease as if it's, you know, just a matter of giving you a shot or taking a particular medical test, but they don't really have any tools or even public health suggestions. You know, for preventing the disease. I mean, a tool would be if you take a certain supplement, the liver might function better, since you've mentioned the liver, or the pancreas might function better. If you eat leafy greens or you eat certain foods, this will improve functioning. So that's one level, what you can do to kind of help your body process this. But another level is, let's not do this. Let's not use these ingredients. Let's not put them out there. So instead, people wind up at the end of the day with all these diseases, and they didn't, you know, see it coming. And then they are sort of trapped in the conventional treatment system after that.
Yes.
I'd love your thoughts about that.
Well, if I could also say, Allison, that Joe talked there about diabetes. When you look at all of the chronic diseases that are epidemic right now in the modern society, all of the ones, diabetes, obesity, autoimmunity, allergies, Parkinsonism, ADHD, autism, these are all strongly linked with multiple environmental compounds that are found ubiquitously throughout the population. So things like new diseases, chemical sensitivity, fibromyalgia, that weren't around before. These are all strongly linked causatively as a cause, not just an association, oh, by the way, these people with this disease have more of this, but as a causation. And this is excellent research, basically, that's been done because there's been the ongoing NHANES trial, National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey. And that's where a few thousand people every year get assessed, including urine, blood, and with all these health indices. And that's where we're now getting from the CDC their annual report on the level of toxic compounds in the North American population. So now we have all these reference ranges for the people in the country, you know, what the average level of arsenic is, what the average level of organophosphate pesticides are, of vehicular exhaust. And a number of articles now have been looked at. Well, in this population, let's look at those with diabetes and with arsenic or with chlorinated pesticides. Or let's look at those with ADHD and this, or infertility, which is a huge epidemic problem right now. And all these major problems and the ones that you see all the ads for on TV for a drug to miraculously help you are all of them associated with these common pollutants that are in our air, food, water, and personal care products.
You know, this is fascinating. This is fascinating because what you're now describing is that there is this data path, there is this research that has been collected, because on a routine basis, if I go to my conventional physician, they're not looking for or at, and it's not a routine part of medical testing to ascertain what particular chemicals any of us carry in our bodies. And, you know, when Bill Moyers did this, I think it's like almost 20 years ago at this point in a
right.
program that he did, and drew attention to this, it was actually mm-hmm. impossible and novel and way, at, you know, because we haven't made it a part of healthcare to do this, then you can't afford to do it, you know, and nobody's offering it very much, or it's rarely offered in exception, you know, in certain settings. I think some you know, functional medicine practitioners do, in fact, look at some of these markers. But what you're, but you know, the average person basically is in ignorant bliss because they don't know, you know, what they were exposed to, because nobody's taken a look, unless they consult
exactly.
a functional medicine doctor. But you know, and I've tried to explain this to people, and it's just like, duh, you know, we're just kind of in ignorance. But as you both point out, because of these new, you know, because of these long-range studies, that data is now there. And so what, mm-hmm. you know, so the data that you just described, Dr. Kinnean, and the analysis of it that you just described, Dr. Pizzorno, really allows us finally to make these correlations of what we are creating for ourselves or allowing to be created. So this is actually, I would say, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like a huge turning point in terms of the science and its application that we didn't have before. And people are always saying, well, show me the science, show me the science. How do you answer that when on the individual level, the science and the data are not being collected? And does this represent a change when now you do have that data on a public health level?
Well, you've covered a lot of territory. Let me just back up in just a second into kind of a big picture thing. So when you and I were writing my book 2 years ago, I was worried that I was overstating the problem because I've been seeing all this research and making all these correlations and publishing some articles on it. But when I was talking to the public, I want to make sure I give people good ideas, good information. So I was a little hesitant in some areas. Now, normally when I write a book for the public, I first write a textbook for doctors and then write the book for the public. This time it was reversed for the first time. But the book for the public and then work with Walter to write the textbook for the doctors. And as I worked with Walter, I started bringing in the areas he'd been researching and then looking at how to compare research areas I was researching. Interestingly enough, we had relatively little overlap because he was kind of looking at some areas he thought were really important. I was looking at some different areas. As I then looked at all the research he had been gathering and looked at with mine, I realized I actually understated how bad the problem was in the toxin solution. It is really bad. And I, there are a couple of areas that I can get into. One of the ones I was not as aware of as I should have been is an area of PAHs, what I call the aromatic hydrocarbons. And these
can you run that by me again, Dr. Pizzorno? I just want to make sure we hear that correctly.
So, so it's kind of a combination of two things. One is particulate matter, and the other is the polyaromatic hydrocarbons.
Okay.
So the particulate matter, things like, you know, you see that black, blue diesel exhaust coming out. You look at that and think, well, that can't be good for us. And the answer is, yes, it's not good for us. And the research that Walter brought up and how bad it is just remarkable. So as we get into this, the numbers keep getting worse. It's not like we're overstating it. It's just that the more we look at the research, the worse it's getting. Okay, so Walter, why don't you say something about the particulate matter PAHs? I thought that was extremely important research that you dug up.
Yeah, the from anything that gets combusted puts out aromatic hydrocarbons and PAHs. So forest fires, barbecues, cigarettes, vehicles, but of all those, the vehicular exhaust is those compounds are the most damaging, and of the vehicles, diesel exhaust is the most damaging. And for instance, let me just give you I rate these vehicular exhaust compounds as the number one health damaging pollutant of all of the, you know, pesticide solvents, everything. I rated it number one because it's associated with increased rates of death, heart disease, respiratory problems, diabetes, obesity, infertility, autism, allergy, autoimmunity, and I might be forgetting some. Oh, yeah, neurologic problems. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yes, there's a woman in University of Montana, Lillian Calderon Garcinuetis, who has done a series of articles working with children in the Mexico City metropolitan area.
Oh, my God.
And comparing kids in an area with really high particulate matter versus areas with lower particulate matter. And the kids who are in the area with the highest particulate matter, she's looking at how it affects their brain. Their cognition, their learning is lower. And in these children with the highest particulate matter exposure, they already have physiologic changes in their brain that is the hallmark of the development of Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, five-year-olds. This is how serious this stuff is. There are studies looking at women who live closest to roadways where there's truck traffic. When they live close to roadways where there's truck traffic, their risk of having an autistic child goes up manyfold. And if that family keeps living there with the child's autism gets worse.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is horrific.
Yes. And there are studies in every single major city across the globe. And when rates of vehicular exhaust in the air spike, within 2 days, fatal heart attacks go up, death due to respiratory diseases goes up, asthma attacks goes up, and these have not just been published in the last 5 years. This research has been being published over the last 30 to 40 years.
Saying it's been known.
It has been known.
You know, I just have to interject something here that I was certainly not planning to bring up in this program, but the last week's Connect the Dots program and the next week's Connect the Dots program are, you know, this is the meat and the sandwich, as it were, but they're on a topic related to this, which is it turns out that in my own home state of New York, the closest aide to the governor was bribed by the gas and oil industry, and therefore the state approved building a gas power plant that is run on diesel energy. That's right. And there has been like a 4-year battle by that community. Of course, it will use a whole, it requires, you know, 150 new gas fracking wells to provide, you know, provide it with what they're going to be processing and then sending abroad. The people, this actually was fired up last week. And so people had a rally yesterday in front of the courthouses where the corruption trial of the Governor Cuomo's aide is now occurring. And people in, you know, so I just am covering this. Last week's show was on it. Next week's show will be on it. And I was at the rally, and people were reporting that they could smell the diesel. And they, you know, woke in the middle of the night and smelled the diesel as that the very day that plant had been fired up for the first time. And they were like, what is this unaccustomed smell in my area? And then they were like, oh, and then some people were like, oh, I'm getting a headache. And it was the diesel plant.
Wow.
And these are actually, this is like in my backyard, supposedly, but in fact, these kinds of plants themselves are going to be built all over the United States. This is just one of them. So I had not been aware of diesel, as you just described it, Dr. Crinian, but wow.
And there are literally thousands of articles on the adverse health effect of diesel exhaust. I am not exaggerating. If you printed them out and full articles and put them in binders, it would fill a bookcase, a big bookcase. This is well known research that has been documented and redocumented multiple times.
Something I'd like to add to this is just a very practical matter. So after so the way we wrote the textbook is Walter wrote about half the chapters, and I edited them, and I wrote about half the chapters, and he edited them. So kind of we looked at each other's work. So after reading Walter's chapters on particulate matter, we installed a new filter in our home, and it's a level called MERV 7. Indication, well, filter things. And Walter says, you want at least MERV 8. So we got a MERV 16. You know, went whole hog
on this. It needs what, Dr. Pizzorno? I missed that.
It's called MERV 16. So actually, Walter, would you describe what that means? You understand this better than I do.
Oh, wow. So all filters, air filters, have a MERV rating, MERV. And it's a minimum efficiency rating value is what MERV stands for. But that's the degree to which it will filter out smaller and smaller and smaller particles. So inside the air in the home, you have a release of numerous things. Now, there are solvents like, paint fumes, stuff from new cabinetry or whatever, or painting. But the bigger set of pollutants in the home is what's called semi-volatiles, or SVOC, and that's the phthalates and the organophosphate pesticides and the PAHs and the particulate matter, all these things, the flame retardants, all the stuff that's found in everybody and comes from the dust because they bind in the dust. So the smaller the particle in the MERV, the more of that stuff it filters out. Now, people get these washable filters that don't filter hardly anything out, or those things that look like spun fiberglass that, you know, keep birds from flying through but don't filter out the dust. And so you need the smaller and smaller and smaller particles. So I recommend that people get at least a MERV 7, which is pretty much the allergy rated filter that you buy at Home Depot or Lowe's or Ace Hardware or True Value or wherever. Joe's got this MERV 16. So it and it's so important. What Joe and his wife have done there is the greatest source of air pollutants we have is in our home, because the home air is filled from the outdoor air. And if you're in an urban area, that's bad. And then added to which are all the things from the furnishings in the home and the cooking and all that. So indoor air pollution is where we really get nailed. And so what Joe has done, and what I recommend everybody do, but Joe has really gone above and beyond, is really take care of that indoor air, because indoor air is in your control unless you're like in prison or in, you know, the military or somewhere. You don't have any control over it. But if you've got your own place, you've got control over your own air. You can control the furnishings you have in the house, your cooking pots, and you can get some type of air purification. And so, golly, Joe, I really applaud you and what you've done.
So here's the story. So, again, thank you, Walter. So we put in this filter, and it's supposed to be good for a year. And then you have to replace it. And it's fairly expensive. So it's like $1,500 to install. It's expensive, and the filter is like $200, the replaceable part. So it has kind of electronic things as well as passive things. So I decided just, you know, okay, fine, it's good for a year, but after 9 months, I'm going to take a look at it. And I was appalled by what I found. It was just, it was totally covered with all this crap, for want of a better term. And so we had to actually replace it early. Actually, I took a picture, and I mean, I'll start showing it in my various lectures, and that is, there's so much stuff. And before you say, well, maybe just have a dirty house, we have white carpets in our house that are 20 years old, okay? So we are fastidious, I should say. My wife is fastidious housekeeper. So our house is kept really clean. Nonetheless, what was in our filter?
I've been there, and I can attest. That is one clean house.
Well, it's also not in the most polluted setting, because I've been there too, and I would attest to that. I mean, it isn't in what would appear to be a polluted setting. Anyway, I mean, maybe we can't even know for sure what is a polluted setting in some cases and stuff.
Well, we're, you know, yeah, that's a good point, Allison, because the level of air pollution nationally is huge. And we also get air pollution is an international problem. So in, like, Joe's up in Seattle, well, the Pacific Northwest gets a load of pollution from Asia. Their ozone from Asia, China and Asia, is found in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. These things, some pollutants travel literally tens of thousands of miles. So, you know, they're doing this now in Europe, where they're realizing, hey, you know, there's now European Union agreements on what factory can produce what chemical and release it, because it gets everywhere quickly.
Wow. Yes, we forget that. So, you know, we absolutely forget that. So, you know, the laws in one place, you know, we may like or not like what the government is doing, you know, but it's actually affecting everyone in the world. You know, I was doing a show a number of years back with a scientist from one of the, you know, kind of environmental research organizations, and he was discussing the global spread of all of these chemicals that are in various products and things, just as we're discussing it now. And at that time, people tweeted in order to ask questions in the show. We don't do that anymore. But and somebody tweeted after he went through this whole thing, and he said that I think, you know, flame retardants were found in the bodies of Arctic residents, was what he specifically said.
Yeah.
And this gal tweeted, where can we move? We want to have a family. So I think the
Antarctica.
You know, well, it's kind of really hard, I think, for, you know, I think we've been kind of led to believe as Americans that we can be entirely self-determining. And of course, it's not to say that there aren't any mitigations, there's no help at all, we should just, you know, despair completely and do nothing. But, you know, there are some ways of personal mitigation, and then there are some things that are going to be very hard to avoid. And, you know, that was for me, I mean, that particular exchange, I was like, even with all the information, somebody is still thinking they're exempt. Maybe they'll go to Mars, you know, next, if they have, the world has been so greatly polluted. You know, is there a way of, once this cat has been let out of the bag, and no offense to cats, certainly they're not responsible, but is there a way to, you know, kind of get any of this back, mitigate it, clean it up, not continue to add it? You know, like, is anything going on in that regard that you're aware of?
Joe, can I jump in there?
Please.
So, Allison, it's now, as far as I'm concerned, it's no longer an option or a luxury. Step one and step two for regaining health, maintaining health and vitality is get air purification in your home. Step two is water purification. Clean air and clean water is, you know, I'd like to think it was just a basic human right, but now you have to take matters into your own hands. And it's only getting worse right now with the steps that our federal government is currently taking. So getting an air purifier in the home is critical. Now, Joe just talked about the money he spent for that. There are, for small rooms, there are very reasonably priced air purifiers that have a nice, you know, high-rated, basically have the high-rated MERV filters that you put in your furnace and in a little box that pushes air through it. And so there are some available like that just for, you know, $200 or $300 that one can get for a small room. And even these have been shown in articles to reduce the particulate matter, which carries the aromatic hydrocarbons. Particulate matter grabs all this stuff, all the aromatic hydrocarbons, and that's what really delivers it into the body. So, I mean, you can get that. You can get water filters in your home. Now, I'm in an apartment right now, but I live in Arizona, and I just go down the street and I fill up for, you know, 30 cents a gallon reverse osmosis water that clears out 95% of the stuff. And I'm in Arizona, so I've got high arsenic in the water. I've got a high hexavalent chromium, which is the Aaron Brockovich toxic compound in the water. Arizona's got high perchlorates, which is from rocket fuel. It's got high MTBE from gasoline. So all this other stuff. So I'm doing RO water. Did I say arsenic? I think I did. So, you know, 30 cents a gallon, that's what I get. And I've got a BPA-free container, and you can use glass. Glass containers work great. So I am in, and I've got my own IQ air filter in my bedroom. So there are ways that you can reduce those exposures. It's really about avoidance. You know, personal care products, avoiding those that are full of the toxic compounds, and then choosing to eat less polluted food. I mean, it really doesn't cost that much more to avoid the major food pollutants. So it's really all about avoidance. It's, you know, you get a little bit of knowledge on what you need to do. It's not going to cost you that much. It's a whole lot less expensive than not doing it and getting these diseases. And let me give you just a quick example.
That's excellent, Walter. I want to add to that. And that is, as you recall, in the toxin solution, again, I say, don't let these toxins in. The reason for that is they were designed to be difficult to break down by biological systems. So one way you can determine how well a body can get rid of a toxin is by looking at the half-life of the toxin in the body. In other words, how long does it take for the body to get rid of half of it? And so we look at things like alcohol, for example. It's a toxin everybody's aware of. Half-life of alcohol in the body is just a few hours. So we're really good at getting rid of alcohol, for example. Mm-hmm. But then you look at something like DDT. You might say, well, why are you worried about DDT? It was banned 43 years ago. Well, the problem is the half-life of DDT in the body is between 2 and 10 years. So once it gets into the body, depending upon a person's genetics, they have trouble getting rid of it, but they're actually still being exposed to it because it's in the environment, and they're being exposed to more than they get rid of. So if you then look at the amount of DDT in people's bodies by age, as people get older, they get more DDT because they can't get rid of it. And if you think that's bad, then you look at the PCBs, the polychlorinated biphenyls. And there's a bunch of these. There's maybe 100 of these different chemicals. And maybe, Walter, you know the exact number. But anyway, a bunch of these chemicals, and their half-life in the body is between 3 and 25 years. So these were banned 41 years ago, but the problem is they're so hard to get rid of that the level of people's bodies goes up as they get older.
So you're basically continually accumulating them, and
yes.
And there it is.
So you, if people get older, we expect there to be a disease. We think as you get older, you get more disease. That's normal. It is normal, but not necessary. But what's happening is people get older, the biological environmental toxins continues to build up, causing physiological damage. But also along the way, we're damaging people's DNA. So now they're less able to adapt to the damaging effects of the toxins. And as more and more DNA is damaged, you get more and more disease because of those toxins. Well, one test that Walter recommends, something called 8-OHDG, it's a urinary measure, and it looks at the amount of DNA damage in the body. And it turns out, as toxic load goes up, so does 8-OHDG in the urine, clearly indicating that we're breaking our DNA. And as you break your DNA, you die faster and you get more disease.
Well, you know, the other thing that strikes me is that, you know, there's a range of things in, as you mentioned, food and personal care products, things used in the home, furniture, clothing, paint, you know, all of those things, particulate matter that enters the home. So there's kind of, you know, my local in area, my home is my castle, you know. How can I prevent the things that might enter the home? How can I lower the level of exposure either through consumer choice or getting products that help filter or that, you know, have lower pesticides or whatever choice of what I eat? So those are all the kind of personal solutions. But, you know, if you then kind of widen the lens and look out on the community level, as Walter was mentioning, it's, you know, you're keenly aware of what the toxic risks are in your community. And I know that the same is true about, you know, you, Dr. Prizorno, and Seattle. And in fact, anybody who's in, you know, the Northwest region should probably get the toxin solution because Dr. Prizorno goes into that in the book, right? So there's our local region. But then there's, you know, these, but as we know, some of these chemicals, as we've been discussing, just travel everywhere. You know, like the people up in Alaska aren't, you know, buying these products. And nevertheless, they're being exposed. As I mentioned earlier, you know, when this diesel power plant, you know, a gas plant has been built in upstate New York, and they're building, they're planning to build, I don't know, hundreds of them all around the country. It's not going to mirror the diesel fumes that and the methane that, you know, were exuded by that plant are not going to be just affecting the people across the street, although they may be the first ones to get the most acute hit and smell it and everything. And, you know, when we talk about the mitigation, you could have a region that has a lot of exposures due to, for example, industrial outputs, like the plant is one example of that, but maybe doesn't have the economic resources to even purchase healthier food or, you know, afford some of these things. So there's actually a kind of level of democracy and health justice, you know, the equal opportunity to even...
You know, Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, has their shopper's guide, which shows the most polluted fruits and vegetable list, and that's from the U.S. FDA. It's called the Pesticide Data Program. And other studies have looked at that food list, you know, that people ate versus their illness. And one of them is a great a set of articles on infertile men and women. And, you know, infertile men and women who eat like men who eat 1.5 servings of those high pesticide fruits and vegetables daily have half the sperm count of those that don't. And a third of those that have sperm are totally abnormal. So, you know, just by looking at that list and choosing something other than that, even if organic is not available, choose something other than that. That's not a high pesticide fruit and vegetable. So just, you know, I mean, that's no extra cost. And people think that, well, if I eat organic, it's going to be really expensive. But like, you know, I have Sprouts by me and I go to Sprouts and they've got organic, commercial apples, you know, $2.49 or maybe $1.99 a pound, and the organic apples at like 50 cents or a dollar more a pound. Well, a pound of apples, I get a lot of apples, so I can get a week's worth of apples and I spend an extra dollar? Really? The extra dollar's not expensive. I can't even get a cup of coffee for that at Starbucks or anywhere else, for crying out loud.
Right.
So we have this thing that it's more expensive, but when you really look at the dollars and cents, it's not. And if you're looking at a young couple who is infertile and is spending $20,000 on average for one round of IVF, and one round of IVF is typically not, does not work. They have to do several. And then because they're toxic, they, even if the IVF is successful, they have a higher rate of having a child with health problems.
Oh, dear.
So why spend $100,000 and have a kid with health problems when you could spend like an extra maybe $10 a week?
Co-op and having the access to food. But there are literally food deserts. There are areas with people who are in poverty or in locations where basically there are no options like that. I mean, those of us who, you know, kind of have the unfortunately declining option of the middle class lifestyle and have the advantages and education to sustain that or have sort of pull, you know, made it a life project to pull ourselves into it, as per the American dream, you know, do have those choices. And so I guess my other question is, what about the people who are kind of out of the picture in some remote area, in some lower economic status, in a food desert, you know, are, as much as I am a champion of integrative medicine, and I hope you don't mind my asking this because I genuinely am, you know, what about the people who, you know, have a much tougher time, you know, may live in even more toxic regions and have a harder access to the healthy options we're talking about for either reasons of what's in their area or their own economics? Is there any help for them?
I would again say avoidance, knowing what the most highly polluted sources are and avoiding them. You know, that would be that's step one. There are you know, basics of a healthy diet that are typically available to everybody, and again, these aren't high cost items because you're buying food anyway. So buying the fruits and vegetables, if fresh fruits and vegetables are available, buying those that are not on the most toxic list.
If you want to add this with Walter.
Can I just say one thing, Joe, before you say that? Is if you want to buy commercial apples, just peel them. How much does an apple peeler cost?
Okay.
You know,
that's
$2. And you clear out 99% of the pesticides from it. Now you, Joe. I'm back to you.
No, that's good. So I want to address two issues here, first off, and that is everybody makes choices every day. And as Walter pointed out, the Environmental Working Group has a great website that'll show you. You're going to make choices if you eat a food that's on the Dirty Dozen list. Either eat it organically or don't eat it. Otherwise, I get the foods that are on the list that are low toxicity. But also adding to this, people need to cook more of their own food. I don't care what the person's income is. You go buy a bag of brown rice that's grown organically and make food from that, and it's dramatically cheaper than any other way you can get food. So I'm getting a little less tolerant of people saying, well, low-income people can't do this. Sorry, Allison. What I'm saying is, we need to educate everybody on making everyday choices. And not only that, not just a matter of avoiding the toxins, but also recognizing there are some dietary changes people can make, some choices they can make, that'll have a huge impact on the body's ability to get rid of the toxins. For example, if you look at many of our detox systems, they're dependent upon there being enough fiber in the gut. So when the liver dumps this stuff into the gut, it binds the fiber and we get rid of it. As evolved as a species, we consumed 100 to 150 grams of fiber a day. Well, now the average person consumes 15 grams of fiber a day, which means our normal detox systems don't work very well. which then makes the half-life so much longer. So foods that are higher in fiber. Foods that are higher in fiber tend to be cheaper than foods that are low in fiber because they have not been processed enough. So a lot of choices people can make to have a big impact regardless of their income.
There are three foods that I would really recommend. One is the brassica family, which is the cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, because it enhances the body's ability to clear these things out. Second is green tea, which does the same thing and has anti-cancer activity. I mean, tea bags are not that bloody expensive, right? And the third one is the spice turmeric, which is in curry, is another astounding compound at helping to protect against these pollutants and clear them out of the body. Just those three things alone, if people will start doing that and knock out the sugar, which is really, you know, health damaging, it can go a heck of a long way. Just, and if you got carpet and you can't tear the carpet out of your house, don't wear shoes indoors. You know, some basic things like that that are so simple to reduce one's exposure and help clear these pollutants out of the body. This is not a hopeless situation at all. The level of pollutants in our body is unprecedented. This is a new issue. This is a new problem. You know, and the CDC, again, has been looking at this and published it in their fourth report, and they're up to now 246 toxic chemicals and metals that they have measured in the North American population. Of those 246, 120 are found in everybody. So that's half. So we have a burden, and there are up to, 3,500 high-use chemicals, which means excess of 1 million pounds a year, and they've only measured 246, and we have half. So it's, yes. Now, the good news is that about 80% of those are not persistent, as Joe mentioned at the beginning of the call. They have very short half-lives. So if you do get avoidance, you can knock down about 80% of the pollutants running around inside your body. That's the good news. But the idea that we don't need to detox is really talk about a head in the sand kind of a fantasy land. It's not the case anymore. You know, maybe back in the 1300s it was okay, but not now.
I just want to thank you both. This has been an amazing conversation. I believe that both of you are going to be at the Integrative Health Symposium coming up in New York in just a couple of days after the show airs. That's going to be at the New York Hilton Midtown, February 22nd and 24th, 2018. It's a fantastic
opportunity. And Dr. Pizzano's getting an award.
And it's a great opportunity for anyone listening to educate yourself more, both to the environmental health impacts, which the two doctors that have been with us today, Dr. Joseph Pizzorno and Dr. Walter Crinian, have been sharing their terrific wisdom. We're definitely going to have them back on the show if they'll agree to come when their book, their joint book, is published. You know, the toxin solution is actually coming out in paperback this very month, shortly. So, you know, get those books and follow those tips and come to the Integrative Healthcare Symposium and learn more about this view of proactive, preventive health care. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners. We'll be back with the next edition of Connect the Dots on Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, as we are every week. Thanks for being with us this week. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.